Portions of the day's programming are reproduced by means of electrical transcriptions or tape recordings.
Testing, testing, hot out, brown cow, 1, 2, 3, 4, testing, testing. Hey, boy, you know, Ralph, I'm getting a little nervous out here. I don't know how you can keep so calm back there.
Get ready. 10 seconds. 5 seconds. Go.
Hey, I can't find nothing on the radio. Yo, turn to that station.
Your one definition of a friend is someone who's there when you need him. Well, I needed him, and he's here. Ladies and gentlemen, my friend Elton
Jim.
Good morning, Elton Jim.
Elton Jim.
The one, the only, Elton Jim Toronto.
I'm back. Good evening. Elton Jim Toronto with you here at WGN AM 720 in Chicago, about 10 minutes after 7. I'll be filling in for Justin Kaufman until 11 o'clock tonight. I'm going to be here for the next 4 hours. I hope you will, too. Got some fun stuff planned for you. I'm just looking out the window here. Once again, as I always say, the Allstate Showcase Studio is the greatest office in the city of Chicago. Can't beat it. Even when the sun is down, there's still a lot of activity and fun around here. So I'm having a ball already, and it's only, what, 2 minutes into the show. We've got some cool stuff planned for you. I was talking to Ro just a few minutes ago. We've got some food things on the plate, if you will. About 7:30, we're going to talk about how the highly guarded secret, the 11 herbs and spices that make up Kentucky Fried Chicken by the good old Colonel Sanders, inadvertently were released, were revealed by our own Chicago Tribune in this very building where I sit, just a few floors up. And not only did they print the story, but I did not know this, but there is a test kitchen at the Chicago Tribune newspaper. And so not only did they find the recipe, they also created it themselves to see if they could match it. And apparently it sounds like they did. So we'll find out just how this guarded secret finally, apparently, because of course KFC has not officially confirmed that it is the recipe. But according to our Chicago Tribune test kitchen people, it tastes pretty close. So we'll get the whole before and after on that. And as I said, later on, we're going to be talking about the Taste of Polonia, which will be starting this week and throughout the Labor Day weekend at the Copernicus Center on Milwaukee Avenue. I'm going to be talking about a play called The Bleacher Bums. If you're a Cub fan and you live in Chicago, you know what a bleacher bum is, and you may be aware of the play that was written back in 1977 by local hero Joe Montagna when he was a part of the Organic Theater Group, and also Dennis Franz was a part of that group and also has a writing credit too. They basically went to, I think Montagna went to a Cub game one time in 1977 and sat in the bleachers and looked around and said, well, there's a play here. And he was right. And as luck would have it, I saw that play back in 1989 when Joe Montagna came back to Chicago and directed it with local actor Dennis Farina in one of the main roles. And I've always wanted to do it, and now I'm going to get a chance to do it. I'm doing a local production. So we're going to talk to the director about the play and give a little self-promotion. Hey, that can't be bad, right? And a whole bunch of stuff. There's a lot of stuff in the news today. It's actually been a pretty interesting news day. I saw the list of new entrants of the Dancing with the Stars. It's amazing how that becomes a headline news. And I usually wouldn't even pay attention to it, except Marsha Brady, Maureen McCormick, is going to be one of the dancers.
And she still looks good.
I'll tell you.
Oof.
Yeah, you know, Marsha. I don't say that with exclamation points. I say that with really sinister and dark thoughts.
Clearly the nose healed well after being hit by the football.
Yeah, you know, I think for most people that grew up in that time, Marsha probably was your first TV crush. Although, you couldn't go wrong with either Marianne or Ginger in the reruns from Gilligan's Island, but Marsha.
I don't want to get too far away from Dancing with the Stars, but Barbara Eden.
Yeah.
Was
oh, yeah.
A fine-looking lady.
We all dreamed of Jeannie.
A few times.
But we never saw that navel. She always had her navel covered in that little Jeannie outfit. Yeah, that was a different time. But I was surprised to see Marsha, not surprised to see Ryan Lotke. So he lost some endorsements, and then he gets on a TV show. Only in America. Lochte, is it? Oh. I was told in my ear by my producer here, Elif, that it's Lochte.
Lochte.
Why don't you come on? What did you just say in my ear?
Lochte.
Yeah. I didn't know what she was even saying.
Lochte.
Yes. What did I say?
Scots Irish.
Lochte?
I think it's Scots Irish.
What did I say?
Lochte.
Lochte. Isn't that some kind of a food?
Treat.
A latke. See, I'm thinking of Taste of Polonia.
Polotsky.
Yeah, Kolotsky, latke. I'm thinking of Taste of Polonia. I don't have lying swimmers on my mind. I've got heavy Polish food on my mind, and we will talk about Taste of Polonia later in the show. Rob Martyr, how are you doing, sir?
See, Jim, I hold out hope for what a great country this is, because if a knucklehead like Ryan Lochte can land on his feet after being nothing shy of a complete idiot, there is hope for you and me.
Well, yeah, but you have to remember the source, too. Dancing with the Stars is not exactly coming back into the... I don't know if that hurts your reputation or helps it, to be honest with you.
I don't know.
Oh, I know. I'm just saying in the look of I guess what I'm saying is I don't put a lot of faith in Dancing with the Stars. I understand it's a very popular show. I don't watch it, so to me, that's probably the only place he could go at this point.
Think of it this way. Unless you are a motorsport fan and follow Indy, nobody knew about Helio Castroneves until he was on Dancing with the Stars.
Okay, I still don't know what you're talking about.
Exactly. And he won the thing.
He won
the golden ball or whatever they call
it.
Yeah,
the mirror ball.
The mirror ball.
Yeah, see, I even hate myself for knowing that they give a mirror ball out.
And you don't watch Dancing with
the Stars? I don't. I really don't. Although Mary Lou Henner is on there, too. Babyface Edmonds. Remember Babyface? He did that song with Eric Clapton, We Can Change the World. He had a few hits a few years ago. So it seems to me that Dancing with the Stars is basically a 2016 version of The Love Boat. Discarded stars or people with some kind of notoriety get on that show. That's basically what it is. It's just an updated version without the ship. How do you feel about that, Rob?
Well,
wow, was there a dead silence there? Hello, Rob?
I mean, you know, are they on the Aloha deck? Are they on the promenade deck? I mean,
no,
what deck
Dolphin.
Are they coming from?
Dolphin. Dolphin or Carib.
We just have a collision of all these TV shows tonight.
So I said, how have you been doing? I haven't talked to you in a long time.
I'm doing well. It's good to see you.
Yeah, it's great to be here. I was here on Sunday. Boy, I could actually get used to it. I wonder what it's like to work here 5 days a week. I wonder what that would be like.
I'll tell you off air.
Yeah. I vaguely remember.
Yes, right.
I vaguely remember. If the day wasn't that too, come on, it wasn't that long ago. Jeez. Wow. Excuse me while I pull that knife out of my back. Wow. It's going to be one of those nights.
Come on,
okay.
You know I miss you.
Okay. Okay. It's going to be one of those nights. You've set the parameters.
Relax.
I will tune into sarcastic mode with you tonight. I was going to try to be nice to you, but now I'm going to, you know, go back to being me. So I hope you'll join. Already the first 18 minutes, exciting radio. I think Bruce Dumont, oh no, he won't be calling from the Museum of Broadcasting, will he? Anyway, can you stay with me? I hope you can till 11 o'clock. I said we got a lot of fun stuff planned as well as I'm really looking forward to talking to the people. 312-981-7200. A lot of times you put together a radio show and you're so paranoid that you want to fill every minute with a guest. A lot of times it becomes like a revolving door. So I'd like about mid-show to open up the phones and hopefully take, and you guys are always welcome to call in, but I certainly would like to get your opinions on a few things that I've got on my mind as well. So hopefully we're going to have fun today till 11 o'clock. I am Elton Jim, filling in for Justin Kaufman here till 11 o'clock, and no switching. And welcome back. Elton Jim Toronto with you, filling in for Justin Kaufman tonight till 11 o'clock. And I was talking with Rob Martyr earlier when we were still friends about the Dancing with the Stars lineup. And one of the people in it is Marsha Brady, Maureen McCormick. And I've got an interesting Maureen McCormick story. Are you there, Rob?
I'm here.
Still talking to you.
I'm listening.
You're on thin ice, but I'll still.
I am zeroed in to your every word.
I'll still acknowledge you. Anyway, so remember the play that was very popular around the country? It was called The Vagina Monologues. And it was here in Chicago and on several occasions. And basically it was three women. And it was a little risque in that that's what they talked about. And it was a very blunt, funny, very poignant show. And they would always have three different women do it. And it was basically like three women sitting on stools having monologues about that particular part of the female anatomy. And some were funny and some weren't. It was an interesting night at the theater. So I went to see it one night when Maureen McCormick was starring in it with a few other people. I can't even remember at the time because it has burned in my mind. And there was one particular vignette within the show where Maureen McCormick basically reenacted having an orgasm right there on the stage. And so as Rob and I were talking, you know, Marsha Brady was for a lot of people your first crush. Now, I did get a text here that said that remember Julie from Love Boat? That was this person's first crush. And she was pretty, but when you were a budding adolescent, you know, you couldn't do better than Marsha Brady. So I'm sitting there and I'm watching Marsha Brady, everyone's fantasy girl, basically having ecstasy and really getting into it. I mean, she was not just pulling punches, and it was almost surreal to see Marsha Brady.
Let me ask you this.
Writhing on a chair and moaning and not, and I mean, and scream. It wasn't just like, you know, I'm embarrassed about this. She just closed her eyes and let it rip.
Compare her orgasm to that of Meg Ryan.
Oh,
When Harry Met Sally.
Meg Ryan, that's training wheels.
Really?
Oh, this was like 10 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah, it was almost to a point where it got uncomfortable, if you can believe that. But I'll tell you, the adolescent in me, as well as the testosterone laden man in me, was watching that and going, "That's Marsha, oh my goodness!" And so, when she was done, there was this uncomfortable silence in the theater because she earned an Emmy or a Tony if she would have been up for one. It was outrageous how the extent that she went. And there was this awkward silence in the audience. And so, of course, Rob, if I'm in the audience and there's an awkward silence, what has to happen?
It's noise.
I need to fill it.
Right. You got to do something.
I need to fill it.
Well, plus we're in radio. Dead air is bad.
Yeah, I heard dead air. So there was this awkward silence for about a minute and a half. The place was silent. Nobody was even clapping. They didn't know what to do. And I just stood up and said, "Thank you so much for that." And the place went wild. They laughed. And I think everyone needed that release because it was actually uncomfortable. I mean, she was sitting on a stool. She had her head back. She was doing everything possible, you know, audio-wise and manipulation-wise. It was both exciting and uncomfortable at the same time. So I figured I need to break the ice.
And, which is usually the case for most men anyway.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And the best part was, when I did that, she looked out into the audience and waved to me. So I got a wave from Marsha. So I felt like I was actually her cigarette after. You know what I mean? So I will always remember when Marsha and I had a moment. And we will be back in a moment. No switching. And welcome back to the show here. Jim Toronto with you, filling in for Justin Kaufman tonight till 11 o'clock. And two Sundays ago, I was perusing my Chicago Tribune, as I am wont to do on a Sunday morning. I'm one of the few people, actually, who get a newspaper delivered 7 days a week. I'm old school. Call me crazy. And so I notice on the front page, there's a bucket of Kentucky Fried Chicken picture on there. And I'm like, oh, what are they doing another story about, who's the next Colonel Sanders lookalike? Boy, was that George Hamilton. Isn't that creepy? I didn't even know that was him. With the tan and the extra crispy. I get it, but it's creepy. So I'm reading the story, and lo and behold, it's not just about Kentucky Fried Chicken or a business story. It's about probably one of the most guarded secrets in corporate America in terms of food is concerned. It's a story about how our good old Chicago Tribune, the building that we're sitting in right now, may have finally, after decades, revealed the recipe of the 11 herbs and spices. And so I'm very excited today to have both Lori Rackle and Joel Gray here from the Tribune to tell us about how this whole thing started. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
I am so excited. Now, this is a two-parter here. So Lori is the editor of the travel section, which is ironic about this story because you didn't go out to find the recipe.
No, not at all.
It's a travel story. Yeah. About what, the museum or something?
Yeah, about the town of Corbin, Kentucky, which is the birthplace of KFC.
Yeah. So in other words, when you assigned a freelance reporter to do this, so in your mind, this is probably just a fun little story that's going to appear in the travel section Sunday, right?
Exactly. Every Sunday we have a food-focused story in the section called Fork in the Road. And so this longtime freelancer pitched me a fork in the road on Corbin, Kentucky. And I said, yeah, go ahead and go to Harlan Sanders Cafe and Museum and report about fried chicken.
And it'll be an interesting little story.
Exactly.
You know, and with the popularity now of these Kentucky Fried Chicken commercials with George Hamilton and, Norm MacDonald and all these folks, Jim Gaffigan filling. And they are a little more higher profile than they used to be. And then so Lori's going to give us sort of the genesis of how the story began and what it became.
Yeah.
But then the cool part of this as well is that, as I said, there's a test kitchen in the Chicago Tribune, which actually makes sense when you think about it because there's a food section. And so they probably cook food. So Joe Gray, you're part of that, right?
Yeah, I'm the editor for Food and Dining.
So now, do you actually cook?
I cook at home.
But you don't cook on... So who does all the testing?
So we have stylists and chefs who come in and test our recipes, style them for our photographs.
So then, in other words, just to make an analogy, on that TV show, America's Test Kitchen, you'd be the guy with the glasses who just comes in.
Yeah.
He just comes in and makes fun of the cook, but doesn't really do anything.
That's right. I do a few things.
No, I'm just having it. So anyway, so you are the editor of the food section.
Yes.
Yeah. So has there always been a test kitchen?
Yeah. That kitchen was built in 95, but there was one before that higher up on a different floor and was all pink. This one they updated, but still that's been.
So are there stainless steel appliances now?
Yes, stainless steel.
Of course. Of course.
Yeah, not kitchen? Pink.
Yeah, an island.
Yes,
of
big
course.
Island where we do tastings.
So there's none of the avocado and orange from the 70s? It's all pretty much...
We have some bowls and pans like that, but not the appliances.
And so the best part is, so Lori and her freelance writer come back with this recipe that they think is the 11 herbs and spices recipe, and then they give it to you, and then you assign someone to actually create it to see if this is actually it.
Yes, and actually Lori came over to me and it's like, handed this to me, and I don't remember quite what she said, but I'm like, is this it? Do you know what we have here?
Yeah.
And we were just kind of in awe. I mean, she had already known about it, but the awe was still in her eyes as we were talking. So,
well, what's so great about the story too is, and like I said, Lori, I want you to give a little of the background of it. But so imprinted in the story, which you almost had to do, is this scrap of paper with the handwritten 11 herbs and spices. And then the key to this really is not just that there's the 11 herbs and spices, which are enumerated as well, which is kind of funny, from 1 to 11, but also the measurements. So that's key. Because it's one thing to have the herbs and spices, but then it's how much of each.
Right.
So explain. So in other words, he just pitched you this story.
Yeah.
And you said, okay, go ahead and do it. Mm-hmm. And so then what happens? He calls you up and says, oh, my gosh.
Well, what happened was he once I gave him the green light to do the story, he called up the Tourism Bureau in Corbin and said, I want to come down and do this story. Is there anybody who used to work at the cafe? You know, because this cafe is on the National Register of Historic Places. It's been there since 1940.
So Kentucky Fried Chicken corporate then doesn't really know this is happening.
No.
They had no hand in
nope.
this.
Nope.
Oh, how interesting.
They're based in Louisville. They're Yum Brands.
Right.
And they are, no, they did not know this.
Oh, I thought maybe they helped set this up.
Oh, no.
Oh, so
they
this will
no
even,
idea.
So this makes the story even juicier, no pun intended.
Yeah. So Jay asked for some help in finding some locals who might, you know, have some history with the cafe. So this this Tourism Bureau person found Joe Ledington. I don't know how. Joe Ledington is the subject of the story. He's the colonel's nephew. He's actually the son of Claudia Sanders, who was Colonel Sanders' longtime wife. And
he's
was
just a corporal, right? Or an ensign?
Yeah.
Is that all?
Yeah. So Claudia Sanders, who is the second wife of the colonel, but was very instrumental in founding KFC and all of that. Her brother, Robert, had a boy named Joe, and that's who we talked to. So he's the colonel's nephew, and he grew up around the colonel and used to work in the cafe, he told us. So he volunteered to talk to Jay, our reporter, and they were going to meet at the cafe and have a discussion about, you know.
And that's a museum?
It's a part KFC, part museum. So you can eat there, but there's also historic memorabilia from the original kitchen and the skillets that the colonel used to originally pan fry his chicken in.
And he used to sell it to like people driving by or
yeah, originally he had
in?
A gas station and he would sell it to travelers and then it expanded to a cafe. He also owned a motel. He was quite the went through a lot of careers in his lifetime. The colonel.
Now you see that now. Goober from Mayberry never served food and that's why he's stuck in Mayberry.
Exactly.
Look at how entrepreneurial the colonel was. So anyway, so your reporter goes out there, meets this guy.
They sit down in the cafe, the very cafe that the colonel used to, you know, sell his chicken at. And Joe has a book with him. And it looks like a, you know, an old photo album, scrapbook type thing. And he starts showing Jay pictures of him and the colonel, you know, 30 years ago and little newspaper clippings. And he says that this photo album used to belong to Claudia, his aunt Claudia, who was married to Colonel Sanders. And then he gets to a part in the back and it's this like it's about 12, 13 pages of paper all stapled together. And he says, this is Claudia's last will and testament. And he starts reading what his father inherited when Claudia died in 1996. And then on the back of it is this handwritten note.
So they're just kind of like flipping the pages.
Yeah. And on the back of that whole document is where this handwritten list of 11 herbs and spices is. And Joe or obviously it caught Jay's attention and Jay's like, what's up with this? And Joe's like, yeah, that's the and Jay said something like, is this what I think it is? He goes, yep, those are the 11 herbs and spices that were supposed to be so secretive.
So he just says that matter-of-factly, like no big deal.
Kind of knowing like, yep, here's the big secret in plain sight.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. So I'm surprised that he would be that open.
Yeah, well, he's only had the photo album for about 4 years because it went through like as various family members died, it was passed around from various you know person to person. So his sister, Joe's sister, died 4 years ago. He came into possession of the photo album. I don't know how many times he's looked at it, but for him, I think the recipe's been in the family. It's not some great big secret. It's just preserved in this photo album.
Well, see,
he's never shown it to a reporter. I don't know that he's ever been interviewed by a reporter.
Well, see, the thing is too is that Kentucky Fried Chicken, the corporate side, they probably didn't know that within the Colonel Sanders family, no one ever told Joe a secret.
Yeah.
They knew he couldn't keep a secret, and this is proof of that.
Yeah.
He couldn't, it sounds like he almost couldn't wait to tell, like, yeah, that's it. And then didn't he say, oh, yeah, I used to mix those for the Colonel up on the roof.
Well, that was how, because Jay's first question was, how do you know? It's not
right.
It's not labeled on here that this is the recipe. We don't know whose handwriting this is. It's not the Colonel's handwriting. I mean, it's written on a will that was written in 1996.
After he died.
Yeah. But we know that Claudia would be very familiar with the recipe. So we don't know if she wrote it. We don't know whose handwriting it is. Joe doesn't either, he says.
Yeah.
But Joe said he was sure it was it because Joe, as a kid, used to help his uncle bag up this mix of herbs and spices and then go around to different, drive it around to different restaurants and sell them the KFC spice blend.
Wow.
So he said he was very familiar with what went into it. This matches it. And here it is in this photo family photo album.
So now does the writer, we should say, is Jay Jones.
Mm-hmm.
So he's a freelance writer. So now does he let on like, oh, my gosh, or does he play it cool?
No, he was pretty like, is this what I think it is?
So he didn't try to mask the fact that, oh, my gosh, I've got the secret recipe here, and I'm going to probably reveal this.
No. He was very, I mean, he took a photo of it. I mean, he was clearly like, whoa, now tell me how you know it's the real deal. And that's what sparked Joe into telling the whole story about how he used to mix the bag, you know, used to mix the blend himself.
So suddenly this non-assuming travel story mm-hmm. about some nice little attraction that might be interesting to some people mm-hmm. takes on this totally new angle.
Right.
So now... He probably takes a picture. He interviews the guy. Thank you very much. So does he write the story? Does he call you up and say, whoa, guess what happened?
Yeah. No, he calls me up and he says, this story might be more than just a fork in the road.
Exactly.
And he happened to be flying in to meet me because I took over this job in January. We'd never met face to face. So he wanted to have a little sit down with me anyway. So he's like, I'm going to bring you what I found, you know, when we sit down for lunch.
Yeah.
And that's when he showed it to me. And we, you know, I'm like, well, how do we know what this is? And we talked more about it. And, you know, he told me he sat with Joe for a long time and he's like, I really, you know, this is what the guy told me, that he really thinks this is the real deal. And then we were off to the races. We're like, we got to try to figure out if it is. And he told me the whole story, the way we wrote it, the way he wrote it here. And it was just such an enthralling story. We thought, even if this isn't it, we just want to like let people know
exactly.
how this unfolded because
exactly.
it's such an incredible story.
Yeah. When I was just reading it, I mean, like I said, it was so fun because of the way the story unfolded in the paper. You're waiting to see,
yeah.
and then you wisely then put, you know, Joe's test kitchen story after it.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, we're leading you up, and now here is it. Is it or isn't it?
Yeah.
And it really did have some drama to it.
That's what we were hoping for.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break here, but we do have Lori Rackel and Joe Gray here from the Chicago Tribune. We're talking about how they have apparently, unveiled, exposed, if you will, the kernel. After 50 or so years, or probably longer than that, the kernel is exposed. His 11 herbs and spices, that is. You know, this still is a PG-rated show. And but it's out there, and it's in print, right?
Yeah, I should mention that KFC has said it's not the real deal, which we expected them to say all along.
Yeah.
So it may or may not be.
Right. But
all we know is the story that we printed in the paper.
Yeah. Well, we're going to be back more about this, because I find what's so cool about this is a pop culture story, it's a business story, it's a human, there's just so many angles to this, because even though everybody isn't talking about Kentucky Fried Chicken in 2016 as they may have done in the early, in the mid-60s or the early 70s when it was really one of the pillars of fast food, even though it wasn't known as fast food at that time. Today, how many people even sit down and cook at all? So maybe someone will use this, some of they won't, maybe as a kind of, hey, as a little fun little thing, look what I made tonight. But 40 years ago, it probably would have been a huge deal. Like, oh my gosh, the empire of Colonel Sanders could be, you know, vanquished. That's probably not going to happen based on this, right?
The interest is certainly there. I mean, we were all shocked at how many page views this story has gotten. It has blown.
Really?
It has gone viral. I mean,
great.
It's been picked up all over the place. So there's certainly an interest there. Now, how many people are going to sit down and make this? I don't know. But we all grew up, didn't we, with hearing that 11 herbs and spices,
oh,
the secret recipe. So
finger licking good. I mean, come on.
How can you not want to know at least what's in it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with Lori and Joe, and we'll continue to expose the kernel right after this.
Kentucky Fried Chicken is really finger licking.
Good chicken.
Kentucky Fried Chicken is really finger licking.
Good chicken!
There's only one Kentucky Fried Chicken, always cooked fresh, with Colonel Sanders' original secret recipe of 11 different herbs and spices. Dinner's ready when you are.
Colonel Sanders, boys and girls, make it really finger licking.
Good chicken.
Well, it's not a secret anymore. Maybe not. It might be officially or not. We don't know. And that's what we're talking about here at WGN. I'm Jim Tirano filling in for Justin Kaufman tonight out until 11 o'clock. I've got Lori Rackel, who is the travel editor for the Chicago Tribune, and Joe Gray, who is the food editor for the Tribune. And together they are, I don't know, Marquette and Joliet, Lewis and Clark. I don't know. They have discovered something inadvertently that never expected to. As I said, they have revealed at least what we may think is the super secret 11 herbs and spices recipe that is at the heart of Kentucky Fried Chicken and which made Colonel Sanders a pop icon that he is today. So so far into the story, we've got as we travel down here, we go to Kentucky. Assuming that we're just going to have a nice little travel story that Laurie decides, yeah, go ahead and tells the reporter, go ahead and write this little story about this little museum. And there are the 11 herbs and spices on the back of the colonel's widow's will. And the key was not just the 11 herbs and spices, but the measurements. Mm-hmm. And so now your reporter comes back, he shows this to you, you're wondering what was going to happen. So now what's your next step? Do you go to Joe to say, try this out, or do you call KFC? What's your next step here?
Yeah, no, we didn't call KFC until we knew we had a story.
Okay.
That was, you know, shortly before we published.
Yeah.
So I talked to some editors, and we decided this is intriguing, certainly worth vetting. So then the consensus was, let's take it to the food team and see if they can recreate it, and let's see how legit it is.
Because, you know, as I was saying to you off the air, you know, how often is a travel story on the front page of the Sunday Tribune? This is a big story.
If I had it my way, it would be every week. Right. But unfortunately, it's not. So,
And you've said that this story has blown up on the internet.
Yeah, it has gone certifiably viral.
And you certainly, once you got to the point where you looked like you had a legitimate story here, as you said, if you vetted this and Joe and his team made the chicken to test it out, you had to know that you had a gold mine on your hands, right? Or did you wonder, are people going to care? Or did you really say, like, well, I think this is going to be a huge story?
I think we all thought that if this plays out the way we thought it may, we were going to have a story that was going to generate a lot of interest. I think it generated more than we even expected.
Really? Even more?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So now you have this story. You're sitting on it. Does he write it up? Or do you go to Joe before he even writes the story?
Oh, we go to Joe. That's the next step. So
right
we're just
away.
Like, take it away, food team.
So now she comes. So now what happens? You go to her office. She comes to your office and throws this picture. So you had a picture of it, right? You didn't have it written down, or did
we
you?
We met in a garage, in a dark garage, in a parking lot, and I arranged trench coats.
It was all dark, and Laurie said, follow the spices. Follow the spices. You're close, but just follow the spices.
No, Jay had sent us the recipe, so we had a printout of it, and I gave it to Joe, and then it was Joe's project to take it from there.
And so, Joe, very quickly, we have to take a quick break, and then we'll go to the news. When you come back, we're going to finish. But just so quickly, so give a little idea of what you and your team do.
So we cover food and dining, so home cooking and eating out, and we have test kitchen here.
So the test kitchen is used instead of trying to expose secret recipes, like in this story. What else does a test kitchen do on a regular basis?
You know, we'll tell you, hey, here's what you should be making this week.
So you'll just test out recipes?
Yes.
And if some are good, then you put them in the paper. If they're not, you don't.
Tomato sandwiches is our cover tomorrow to celebrate the end of summer.
Nice.
And, here's four great tomato sandwiches for you to make for Labor Day.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Tomato sandwiches.
Things like that.
Nice. Yeah. So that's what you do on a regular basis?
Yes.
And you're in relatively good shape.
Thank you very much.
I mean, I would think that the editor of the food thing would be, you know, a huge guy.
I tried to blame my weight gain about 12 years ago on one of our chefs, and he wasn't having it. He blamed it. He said, that's yours.
We're going to take a quick break, and then after the news, Laurie and Joe are going to stick around as we continue this saga here of the revealing of the Kentucky Fried Chicken, we think, the chicken, the you know, herbs and spices, the secret recipe. And Joe is going to take over a little here and give us a chance of a little insight as to how now you took this and brought this to life, and then you guys had to come together again and put the story together. But I just thought about it. No, you're not Lewis and Clark. You are the Woodward and Bernstein of chicken.
Chicken leeks.
There you go.
Yeah.
So you would. I'm gonna say, you know, since you're a little blonder, you look more like Woodward.
Okay.
And you actually do look like Bernstein. You got the hair. So,
be,
yeah, this
yeah.
is Woodstein. I got Woodstein in the audience who broke open Watergate Schmuttergate. These guys broke the 11 herbs and spices recipe. To me, that's more important. We'll be right back.
We start with good, fresh chicken, like we know we should.
11 herbs and spices make it finger-licking good.
We use fresh
fresh chicken, not frozen.
It's the Colonel's secret recipe that makes it...
Well, it's not that secret anymore, now is it? Or is it? We don't know. Jim Toronto here, filling in for Justin Kaufman tonight. And I am speaking with Lori Rackle and Joe Gray of the Chicago Tribune. And they have together become the Woodward and Bernstein of the fried chicken industry by uncovering perhaps the biggest scandal since the Chick-fil-A scandal, which I don't even know if there's a Chick-fil-A scandal. but no, they have stumbled upon, which is the way some of the best stories in the world wind up getting uncovered. By accident. You guys have done the penicillin of stories here by finding something by accident. But they have found the what looks like to be the secret recipe of those 11 herbs and spices that makes the Colonel Sanders chicken finger-licking good. So Lori and Joe have been telling us how this story has unfolded. And so at this stage in the story, Joe now, who is the editor of the food section at the Chicago Tribune, he gets this information from Lori and her reporter, who he believes has found the 11 herbs and spices handwritten on the back of Colonel Sanders' widow's will. So now you get this, and what happens there, Joe?
So we know we want to test it, and this is going to help us vet the story. And I want to keep a lid on what we're doing at the same time, and... So I don't tell any of my staff.
So this is like a big secret. So this is like Watergate.
Yes. Yes.
See, so, I'm telling you, I'm so glad I stumbled on this Woodward and Bernstein thing. So now you've got this.
Well, the
did you tell, are last, you married, Lori?
I am.
Did you tell your husband?
I probably shouldn't say. He works at the Sun-Times.
Oh, okay. See, this is even more incestuous than I thought. This is great. Great drama here. So anyway, okay. So now you didn't tell anybody in your family or anybody?
I told my husband.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but when I had to tell the test kitchen chef, the recipe tester,
right,
Lisa Schumacher, what we were doing, because otherwise she would not be able to shop or prepare, right, and so forth. So I sent her a note. Usually,
plus it's fun.
Yeah, but I told her, I need you to get fresh spices of these 11 herbs and spices.
Is that the way you put it?
Yes.
These special herbs.
And I did not say, we're going to be testing a fried chicken recipe. I can't tell you what it is. Don't tell anybody. Don't tell your husband. Don't tell your children. And you're going to have to make up the frying part.
Ah.
Here's what I know. And I had done a little bit of research, and other outlets and other food writers had investigated a little bit and thought they had developed the way that it's first dunked in buttermilk and so forth, and okay, let's try that. But you're going to have to try several different cooking methods and get these spices.
Yeah. So now you're off to the races. That she gets the herbs and spices.
She gets it, and she, you know, comes in that next Tuesday.
Are you watching this, or are you just waiting for the results?
How
involved are you?
Well, I'm not in there in the kitchen with her.
You're not watching.
No, I kind of go in the morning, say, what do we got? Are there any questions on what we're doing today?
So you're Ben Brantley. You're Jason Robards. You're going, we don't have it yet.
Yeah, that's me. Yeah.
We need more spices.
Yeah. Well, so, and then the photo studio's right there, so the photographer needs to know what we're doing. And, of course, I have to tell them at that point, this is what we're doing. Don't tell anybody. Don't put it on social media.
Yeah.
The last thing I need is like, oh, we're testing something secret. You know, that's why I didn't tell my staff that they can keep a secret. But
because you've been sitting on this story basically since you said April, right?
Yeah, the beginning of May.
And now it just appeared in August.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a chance that you could have gotten scooped on this too.
Yep.
So yeah,
or that someone like let it slip.
You guys are good. Unlike Joe, the colonel's nephew, you guys are good at keeping a secret. Clearly, because that you guys were able to keep this under wraps, especially in this social media world.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. So then when it's time, when the first batch is ready and it's time for that first tasting, I call the staff in and I say, okay, no cameras, because everyone starts taking photos for things on social media. This is what we're doing today. Yeah. So no cameras, no texting, no Twitter.
You think you're going to a Beyonce concert or something.
Yeah. And so that made them excited because they're intrigued. And then we had that first testing. And
so were you there for the first testing,
Laura? I dropped in for a little part of it, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I'm just, my gosh, Joe, you have to invite her.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. And our boss, of course.
Okay. Yep. So was there like a buzz in the newsroom, or did, or you really kept this under wraps so a lot of people didn't know what you guys were, pardon the pun, cooking up here?
I did not talk outside of our department.
Okay.
No.
So there was no, like, around, you know, the, no, the actual, the Tribune,
no,
you know, newsroom, no one really knew what was going
Reporters
on.
Reporters are gossips.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, they don't want it. Of course. They're the worst. My gosh. Yeah. Why do you think they became reporters? They want to tell secrets.
We like knowing things.
Yeah.
And then when you know things, you want to share that, right?
Yeah, yeah, right. So, yeah. Information is power, my friend.
Yeah.
So anyway, so then how many batches did it take until you were feeling like you were at least on the right track here?
Well, I felt that by the second or third batch, we felt we were on the right track.
Because you had to also do, an important thing is, so while the 11 herbs and spices were listed on this, you know, handwritten list here, the measurements of each, it was TS, right?
Right.
So you didn't know whether it was tablespoon or teaspoon.
Right. So that's what we tested first. And it definitely was the larger amount. When we did it with the teaspoon measures, it was
nothing.
Nothing. It was like, it's not right. Yeah. And the whole time we had a huge bucket of KFC from down on.
Oh, right. Yeah, because you have to. Right.
Yeah.
You've got to have.
Yeah. So we weren't relying just on our taste memory. We like had a huge bucket there.
And we should say too that this was not the extra crispy. This is the original recipe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So within the second or third batch, we knew that this was really close and was just about trying a few more ways. Double dipping, single dipping. We had to get the temperature right. We had a little trouble with our frying thermometer. So,
who doesn't?
Yeah. By the fifth or sixth time, that's when we had it.
Wow. Well, we're going to let you – we're going to take a little tease again. We're going to take a quick break here and then find out when the – when the taste buds got involved here and what the reaction was when you decided that I think we have cracked the code. It's almost, let's see, you might be like Tom Hanks and Da Vinci. I'm just trying to think of all these different codes that you two can now lay claim to. But I'm liking the Woodward and Bernstein. Yeah, it's Chicken Gate. We'll just go with that. Anyway, I'm Jim Toronto here, filling in for Justin Kaufman until 11 o'clock. So stay tuned as we get the end of the exposure of the Colonel. And you can obviously tell that I am not picking the bumping music here because I would never pick a song with that heavy of a drum beat. Although, what is this song? I like this song.
It's Stupid... Hold on.
It's what?
Stupid Girl by Garbage.
By Garbage.
Yeah.
I guess, you know. We had The Who, and people thought that was stupid. So how stupid is Garbage? Anyway, Jim Toronto back here at WGN. I'm with Lori Rackle, and it is Rackle, by the way. I'm saying your name, correct?
Yeah. Right.
Okay, and Joe Gray. I say that after I've talked to her for an hour. I finally ask her if I'm pronouncing her name right. And they are from the Chicago Tribune, and they're talking about the story they did a couple of weeks ago on the front page of the Tribune, revealing, we think, maybe, sort of, could have be, the 11 herbs and spices that make up that finger-licking good chicken by Colonel Sanders. And so, Lori... is the editor of the travel section of the Tribune, and she got the story in motion. And after that was revealed that their reporter happened upon the 11 herbs and spices by visiting a museum and diner where the colonel once worked, it was off to Joe and his team in the food page to test this out. So now you've made five or six batches, and finally, what do you think happens?
Well, we think we have it.
And you had a legitimate bucket of real chicken from the Colonel.
Yes.
And sit to test it, and you're like, okay, this is pretty close.
The biggest thing we found was that everyone liked our chicken better.
Really?
Yeah.
It's wow.
Kind of the thinking is like, if KFC was like this, then we would like it better.
Wow.
And that could be because it's a lot fresher, probably better quality chicken. Everything we got was just from the grocery store, but...
Because usually it doesn't taste as good when you make it at home than it is in the restaurant.
Right.
Wow. No. So there you go. So now you say, but now tell the secret thing here is, first of all, it was interesting when the colonel's nephew, who kind of revealed this by mistake, and there's a great picture, which I have the picture, and we were just talking off the air, and even Joe didn't notice this. So there's a picture of the colonel's nephew who said, oh, yeah, that's the recipe. It's right there. They're in this picture. This is in this diner museum. And the recipe was in this scrapbook that Joe, the nephew was he a nephew, a cousin, nephew?
Joe's the nephew.
He was a nephew. Girl. And he was showing the reporter. And this is a great picture because it's taken in the diner, which is a working diner apparently. And there are people eating in the diner. And to the left of where Joe is showing a picture of him and the colonel he's all proud of, there's the recipe. There's the 11 herbs and spices sitting out in the open. The guy in the right behind him could see it. Anybody could have found these recipes. This is amazing. This guarded secret. Now, what's the deal, too? Isn't it in some safe or something in the headquarters?
Oh, yeah. And Yum Brands is the parent corporation of KFC, and they're based in Louisville, and they make a big production about saying the lengths they go to protect the recipe, the original recipe written by the colonel, they say is locked in a vault that's got 24-hour surveillance with like 7-foot, it's like an Ocean's 11 kind of escapade to get into it.
Exactly.
But they play that up. And when they beefed up security, they used a Brinks truck to move the recipe. So, I mean, they definitely like the mythology of...
But they weren't at Joe's Diner.
No.
Where it's laying out for anybody to see. They're lucky that the guy sitting there eating didn't use as a napkin.
Yeah.
I mean, he's that close to it.
Yeah.
Jeez, my hands are so greasy. Do you got anything? Yeah. And Joe goes, here, use this piece of paper with the recipe on it. So now you did call KFC, and they sort of did a usual denial, as you'd expect.
Yeah. Yeah. At first, their denial was very, very roundabout. It wasn't even a denial. So we went back to them right away and we said, you give us a yes, no, or no comment.
And on these 11 herbs spices and on these measurements.
Yes, we showed them the exact measurements. And and so they had that at their disposal. And they came back then with a bit of a stronger denial, saying many people over the years have thought they've found the recipe and none of them have been correct.
Right. And then what was interesting was, Joe, you said that, first of all, Joe, the nephew, had told your reporter that, one of the main spices there was the white pepper, because a lot of people in the 40s and 50s didn't use white pepper, and that sort of enhanced the flavor. Did you find white pepper to be a key ingredient when you guys made it?
Yes, we did. Everyone really thought that really is what kind of nailed the flavor of the KFC chicken.
But there is a little side note to this then. While you had it, in terms of comparing it one to the other, there was another ingredient that was used by one of your reporters, right?
Yes. So we've spent a day testing this kitchen, tasting the chicken, and everyone felt, this is it. It's a little bit not quite there. This could be it. And one of our writers, Nick Kindlesberger, who has an excellent palate, is a great food writer, he gets this look on his face. You can hear almost the wheels turning in his head. And he walks over to the other side of the kitchen where spices are, picks up a container of Accent, and I don't know why we have MSG in our test kitchen. We don't use that in our recipes. It may be from a story we did a couple years ago. Anyway, he sprinkles it on his piece of chicken and tastes it, and that was it. That was the missing thing.
So now the question is MSG maybe used today, but was it used by the colonel 40 years ago when he did it?
And we don't know.
Yeah.
We don't know.
So there is still some mystery then.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But when you taste it, that tipped it over.
That was
MSG.
Was it. Yeah.
Wow. That's interesting. And then we were talking before, in hindsight, is this a fun story? It's human interest. It's pop culture. It's business. But when you look at it, as you said, they go to all these lengths with Brinks trucks and all this stuff. But at the end of the day, this really isn't a bad story for Kentucky Fried Chicken. Even if this is the recipe, this really isn't bad for them.
I would say it's certainly not. I mean, it's a bunch of free media that they've gotten over the past 10 days, and everybody's talking about KFC, it seems like.
It's not going to bring down the empire. Everybody is not going to sit at home now, start making chicken instead of buying it. And to be honest with you, as I was telling you off the air, this brought Kentucky Fried Chicken and that taste into my brain and my palate, where I'm more likely to go to Kentucky Fried Chicken and buy some than buy all these ingredients and try to make this at home. Yeah. So it actually becomes a win for them.
I think so, yeah. I mean, they certainly have not reached out to us to tell us to, you know, stop, you know, to strengthen their denial or to file an injunction or anything like that. We haven't heard from them since our original.
Well, congratulations. This is one of those great stories where, like, it happens by total chance. And as I said, you guys are the Woodward and Bernstein of Kentucky Fried Chicken. And I would assume, following suit, we will see a movie of how this came together. And I'm sure a Pulitzer is right around the corner. So I'm just happy to say that I knew you when you guys would still do a radio interview, because I'm sure within the next month, you guys will be untouchable, and you'll have your own agents, and you'll have a reality show, and you know, you'll be far off from what you used to be, which is a nice group of good, hard-hitting reporters. How was your day? Give me a call at 312-981-7200. What happened to you today? Did you have a good day today? Let me know. Let's share. 312-981-7200. We'll be back after this. See, now Elif is playing a little of my music, a little general public. I should say, Elif, you are quite the music maven, aren't you?
I like to think that I am.
Yeah, I mean, I've been on your Facebook page, and you do a lot of reviews, and you get out to see a lot of the shows.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. What is your favorite type of music? This is Elif, my producer for tonight, by the way. So what's your what's kind of your favorite style of music? Garbage? Big Garbage fan?
No, I'm not a big fan of Garbage.
But you played them.
I do like that one song.
Okay.
I listen to a lot of different genres. I like electronic, but I also like just alternative rock. I love one of the first bands that I really got into and really shaped my musical interest was Radiohead.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah.
Big Tom York fan.
Yeah, good.
Well, look at her. What are you? She looks at me like, oh my God, you've heard of Radiohead?
No.
Oh my God, you've heard of Tom York? I mean, I know you look like you're 100, but it's great that you've heard of a band that was from the last 10 years. That's awesome. No.
It's been 20 years.
I know. Hey, I was listening to the Benz album and the A Computer album before you were born, okay?
Okay, Computer and Kid A.
I was testing.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, right. I'm a good faker up to a point. No, I do like some Radiohead, but some of that electronica stuff and some of that kind of, you know, that machine kind of music, I'm not too crazy about. I call me crazy, but I like a melody.
Yes,
I like know. A melody.
Yeah, I understand that.
But I've been liking the bump music that you've been playing so far.
Oh, thank you.
But yeah, but definitely General Public was one of my when I was in college. And I had a music radio show in college. I mean, that was in the mid-80s. So, I mean, General Public was huge. We played Tenderness and all those songs. But
I only know that song from the movie Clueless. I used to love that theme, that ending theme.
So that's how you know that song?
Yes.
And it just goes to show you, I didn't even know it was in Clueless.
You didn't?
Okay. That's Jim, okay. It's Jim Toronto here filling in for Justin Kaufman tonight. And as I was saying before the break, you know, we all live every day here. We get up, we go to work, we do whatever we do. We run errands, we take care of the kids, whatever it is that you do on a daily basis. And when you come home at the end of the day, you sort of do like to have someone to say, well, how was your day? What did you do? And so I thought I could be your radio spouse if maybe your spouse at home isn't greeting you like Edith Bunker used to when Archie came home. She'd run across from the kitchen to the front door and go, hello, Archie, how was your day? And so I'm asking you, how was your day? And Dottie is going to tell me how her day was. How are you doing, Dottie?
I'm doing great. You know,
can I ask you, wait.
Okay.
Dottie? Yeah. How was your day?
It was wonderful.
Well, no, you don't have to. You don't have to do Edith Bunker back to me.
That was wonderful.
So, how was your day?
Well, we're retiring and moving to Florida, so everything I do is very precious to me.
Wow! Congratulations.
And, yeah, thank you. Like this month, and so this morning I started out going to a meeting of the Boeing League that I've been treasurer of for 8 years, and you know, showing the new treasurer all the reports and things. And,
you know, you got to show him how to fill in if it's a strike or a spare. You know, where are the extra pins at? Where are the extra gloves at? Where are the extra shoes at?
Money.
Oh, money. I thought, you know, we keep all the official shirts over here.
Well, no, it's kind of how to handle the money.
No, I'm just giving you a hard time, but
no, I know.
No, so how? So tell me where. This is exciting. Where are you? Have you been a lifelong Chicago resident?
Well, 36 years.
And where were you before that?
I'm a New Yorker.
Oh, hey, I love New York. I love New York. I'm one of the few Chicagoans who doesn't hate New York. I love New York.
I moved here in 1980, and they still weren't speaking to me because of the 69 Mets.
Oh, geez. Come on. Get over it. Get over it. But yeah. Anyway, so you've been in Chicago. So now where are you going to move in Florida?
Cocoa Beach.
Nice. Cocoa Beach.
Yeah.
That's, you know, how funny. Earlier in the show, I know Cocoa Beach, basically, because on the show I Dream of Jeannie, that's where Jeannie and Major Nelson lived.
Everybody says that.
Yeah. And Rob Martyr and I were just talking about Barbara Eden. And so there, you go, small words. So Cocoa Beach, huh? Nice.
Yeah. And then I went down to Olympia Fields, and I volunteered for the Illinois PGA Championship. And,
oh, look at you. Yeah, so you're quite the sports person, huh?
we're saying the hardest thing for us is we don't just live here. We have a life here.
Yeah.
And we're leaving a lot of stuff. We sing in our choir, and I'm in dog rescue, and my husband sings in a German chorale, and, you know,
nice.
We're leaving a lot of stuff.
Well, don't worry. I mean, but this is also exciting. You're going down to Cocoa Beach. There's going to have nice weather there. And believe me, it sounds like you are a very social person. I'm sure you're going to have no problems finding things to do and people to hang with. And, and I'm sure you're going to make some new friends. And I'm sure there's bowling in Florida. And we know that there is certainly golf, so you'll be able to golf. So it sounds like you're a golfer too, huh?
I am. It's a very bad one, but I love it.
Hey, everybody's the only people who are good golfers are the ones on television. All the rest of us are horrible golfers, no matter what anybody, whatever they tell you. Oh, you know what I shot? You didn't shot anything. Unless you shot a 74, don't talk to me.
Absolutely.
You're out there just like the rest of us hacking. Because I got news for you. If you shoot a 90 or 150, you're still all in the same bad golfer category.
I know.
Right?
But I love people, and I'm really looking forward to this as an adventure. But everything that I'm doing now for the last time is so much more meaningful, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
Bye.
Well, that's great, though. Congratulations. It sounds like you guys certainly live a full and happy life, and you deserve to go retire and take it easy and do what you like to do. So congratulations. I'm glad you hit. So it sounds like you had a really fun day today. You did some nice things.
Wonderful day.
You helped some people. You sort of reconnected, maybe saw some people you may not see in a long time, and you did some volunteering. All in all, for you, August 30, not a bad day.
Great day.
Well, good for you.
Thank you. And you know what? I love you. You're doing a great job.
Oh, thank you so much. I love doing it. I wanted to do this since I was 12 years old. So right now when I sit in the studio, I'm like a kid in a candy store. But I really appreciate you, your kind words, and have a great retirement.
Thank you.
I hope I can meet you soon and move to Cocoa Beach as well. That's my goal.
We're getting a house with a pool. So come on down.
Oh, see that? Look, what are you complaining about? You're going to have a house with a pool. Those pool parties at Dottie's house. I can only imagine. The pina coladas are going to be flowing. Like, oh, my God. Who are those party animals that just moved on down the street?
You betcha.
All right. Well, congratulations and great. I'm glad you had a great day today.
Thank you so much.
All right. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right. And we're going to continue with whatever this has been for the last couple hours. And we've actually got two more to go. So I hope you continue. I'm here till 11. I don't know about you, but I'm staying till 11. I hope you do too. So keep it tuned right here to 720. No switching.
And on the seventh day, the Lord rested and came to beautiful Wrigley Field to watch the Chicago Cubs play his own game on his own green grass under his own lights. Hey, Greg, how you doing?
Bye, Mr. D.
If that voice sounds familiar, it should if you are a fan not only of stage and screen and television and local Chicago theater. It is none other than Joe Mantegna. And that's one of his opening lines from a play that he conceived and performed back in 1977 at the Organic Theater. And later actually came back and directed a version back in 1989 called Bleacher Bums. And if you're a Cub fan, you certainly know what a bleacher bum is. But back in 1978 or in 79 or 77, the bums were really bums. And I am really excited because I've got Joe Mantegna on the phone. How you doing, Joe?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you so much for calling. I had a friend of ours that that said, I know Joe, and I'll see if he has some time. I'm sure. Are you filming Criminal Minds as we speak?
I am indeed. I just got home about an hour ago, and I'm knee deep in that. Right.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for taking the time. The reason I wanted to talk to you, if I had the opportunity, was that I am currently in rehearsals for a production of Bleacher Bums, and I'm playing Marvin.
Oh, excellent!
And so. I was hoping, since you conceived this show and co-wrote it with many of the people at the Organic, most notably as well, Dennis Franz, another great Chicago actor. First of all, if you have a few more minutes, I don't want to take too much of your time. But so you went to a Cub game one day in 1977 and came away and said, wait a minute, there's a play here.
Yeah, I mean, what it was is I was a small child, and it then evolved in becoming an actor and had to get into the acting profession. I used to sit in those seats and think, what is it that draws 35,000 people out here to what was basically, a somewhat mediocre team?
At that time, yeah.
If I can get a tenth of this audience into a theater. So, I mean, it was really that. In other words, what is it about fans and what is it about that will cause a fan to support a team that, you know, is like marginal somewhat, you know what I mean?
Right.
So, really the genesis of Bleacher Bums, of exploring what it was. And the section I sat in the bleachers, I thought there's enough characters here to create a play. And I talked it over with the rest of the company at the Organic at the time and said, I think I've got the genesis of a play here. If you'll all come with me and sit in the section of the bleachers and that's basically how it started. We all agreed that this was something that needed to be done and Bleacher Bums was created.
And it's maintained its popularity. It's continued to do productions all around the country. You guys brought it to Broadway. So I mean, this was not just some little local popular show. This turned out to be
Not at all. We in fact, it ran 10 years in Los Angeles.
That's what I mean, yeah.
From 1980 to 1990 in a Wager Theater out here. So it does transcend the Cubs in a way, and it transcends baseball. It's really about, about the underdog, about the fan, about the people who through thick and thin will support, the team or the individual or whoever it may be that tries very hard yet still hasn't quite gotten there yet. And so... But at any rate, I'm hoping that this is the year that my play becomes obsolete.
Yeah, there you go. Well, I tell you, first of all, back when you were going to see those games in 1977, the bleachers were the worst seat in the house and the cheapest.
Right.
And now they're considered the best seat in the house and among the most expensive.
Right.
And
the way it is.
And as well as you said, now you got to remember back in 77 when you were there with some great Chicago Cubs like George Mitterwald and Jerry Morales, right. They were not a very good team.
No, I mean, look, my mother's going to be 101 in about 2 weeks.
Oh, my gosh. Congratulations.
World Championship. Yeah. I think to myself, well, she hasn't seen them win a World Championship yet. But, we're hoping, we're getting close. And my mom's hanging in there. So God bless her. She's healthy. And
oh, that's great. Well, I hope she hangs on because just tell her to hang on till like November.
Yeah, really. I think she will. I think she's in pretty good shape.
Well, that's great. That's a great because it's funny that you say that because I thought about this too. My father passed away about 10 years ago, and he had a friend of his that was a diehard Cub fan, and he was 81. And I said, poor Mono never lived to see a Cubs World Series. There was so many people that literally lived a lifetime.
Right.
That's unbelievable.
Right. Well.
So tell me now. So, as I said, I'm playing Marvin, and I saw your 1989 production when you came back to Chicago and directed it at the Organic.
Right, with Dennis Farina.
You had Dennis Farina and J.J. Johnston.
J.J. Johnston, yeah.
Yeah, and in fact, J.J. played my role, Marvin. Now, the edition that we're doing is an updated edition that's actually was done in 1998. So I'm kind of disappointed because I would love to have done the original with all those old names like Ted Simmons and, as I said before, Jerry Morales. And
sure, Bruce Sutter.
Bruce Sutter, yeah. Now they've changed it to Rod Beck and, you know, Mark Grace, right. Which is fine.
It's still apropos. I mean, you can change the names, but the basic, you know, until they close the deal, the theme of the play still is relevant. You know?
Exactly. So my question now, because I mean, this is a rare opportunity for an actor to actually talk to the playwright, and get some tips. So was there like a real Marvin? And I should say that Marvin, my character, is like a professional gambler. Kind of a degenerate gambler, professional gambler, who will bet on anything and basically comes there to make his living.
Yeah, there really kind of was. I mean, all the characters were loosely based on either individuals or people we noticed, or, you know, some of them were a compilation of people. Like, I mean, the cheerleader was a compilation of all those guys, a lot of them Vietnam vets that used to be what they used to call the bleacher bums out in left field.
Right.
And then the woman, Zig's wife, was this woman who used to come to the game. She wasn't really married to the guy that played Zig. But we kind of put them together. And then the blind character, Greg, he was a compilation of three blind guys that used to sit there together. And one of them had a cowbell and the other guy had the radio.
Oh, wow.
I mean, everybody kind of exemplified real kind of individuals. And Marvin was this one guy. His name was Ron, I remember at the time. And it was funny when a lot of them came and saw the play, ultimately, when they heard they inspired these characters. And I remember when Ron saw the play. It was so typical. It was perfect Marvin line, because after he saw the play, he says, "Yeah, the play was great. Which guy was I?" You know, he didn't even see himself in there in that guy. I kind of flattered him. I said, "Well, actually, I patterned Marvin after you, but you notice at the end, you know, you were the smart guy. You were the only guy that made any money."
Exactly. Yeah. You bet against the Cubs the whole game.
Yeah. So, I mean, he had the prophetic line. Nobody ever went broke betting against the Cubs after the 4th of July.
Hey, I like the way you still remember the line. Nice.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I remember most of the lines. That's
great.
Hard to forget them. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, as the Marvin character, you gave me some nice meaty lines to play about, you know, how the Cubs are springtime wonders and heartbreakers, and Chicago's a bunch of masochists. They love to see themselves get beat.
Yeah.
So there's some nice meaty stuff, and even especially toward the end there when get some nice little things to sort of attack this Richie character who's kind of a nerdy guy. So it's really a nice meaty part. But I was just wondering. So I'm playing him kind of. I mean, it says in the description he's sleazy. Now, would you consider him sleazy?
No.
See,
no,
I wouldn't. No.
No, you shouldn't. In fact, Marvin. I mean, Marvin is. You have to think about it. He's the winner. He's a winner. Marvin is not sleazy. I mean, what I think to real Cub fans, they may think of him coming off as being like that sleazy guy because he's, you know, he's betting against the Cubs, and a real Cub fan might that disturb him. But you can't look at it that way. I mean, that's the thing about acting. I mean, when you're playing what ultimately is perhaps the villainous role in a way,
right?
That guy doesn't think of himself that way. He's the smart guy. I mean, as I said, at the end of the play, you know, Marvin walks out of there. He's got a smile on his face. He won. So it's all based on perspective. But I think it would be wrong to think of him as sleazy.
Yeah, no, I don't. No, I'm not. I'm playing him more as kind of like a street smart kind of guy that is looking at the odds here and trying to find a sucker for his next bet, and trying to be a little smarter than the rest, because there is even a line there that says, "Hey, the only reason I'm sitting here betting with these guys because I know I can't lose. Otherwise, I'd be at the track."
Right. And he says the line to Decker when he basically says, "You know, your problem is you bet with your heart and not with your head."
Yeah.
And you know, and that's always been the case with Cub fans in a way for all these years, but. That's what makes him, you know, that's what makes being a Cub fan such a unique thing in life. It's easy to be a Yankee fan. Very hard to be a Cub fan.
Well, believe me, I grew up on the Northwest Side about 5 miles from Wrigley, right off of Addison. I've been suffering with them as long. And the one thing, I know you keep very close to your Chicago roots. In fact, you have a Chicago-based restaurant in Los Angeles.
Yes, we do. We do have a restaurant called Taste Chicago in Burbank. We actually did a podcast there on Sunday just before the Cubs-Dodger game here.
Oh, very cool.
And on Friday, I was at the Cub-Dodger game out here. On Friday, you know, Tom Ricketts was out here, and he had a whole bunch of Chicago, you know, LA-based Chicago celebrities at the game. So I was there with Bonnie Hunt.
Oh, nice.
Tom Dreesen and Bob Newhart and Jim Belushi.
Oh, wow.
So it was a great cross-section of Jeff Garland And a couple of the Cubs were there. Rick Sutcliffe was there.
Oh, the Red Baron, of course.
Yeah, so we had a wonderful, wonderful evening, and the Cubs won that game on Friday night, so it was perfect. It was a perfect night.
Yeah, that's great. Well, like I said, what's neat about this show is that not only does it try to capture this moment in time, with the Cub fan, but it really is an allegory for the city as well in terms of, you know, kind of that second city underdog, kind of reputation, that because we're always in the shadow of New York, whether we want to be or not. And so it really does play to that, too, is that there's these diehards who are always looking at themselves. They're kind of losers outside, but when they get into Wrigley Field, they're in their element and they're not losers anymore.
No, exactly right. Hey, look, we're still the city of big shoulders. You know, Carl Sandburg was right. You know, it's the packers of wheat, and you know, the meat packers,
right?
Stackers of wheat, packers.
Well, I have to thank you too, because not only did I see the play in 1989 that you did, and that's why I'm very excited to be doing this. But one time I was on a plane back from Chicago, and you don't remember this, and I wouldn't expect you to, but I go to my seat, and there's Joe Mantegna in the seat next to me. And we sat together, and I had just interviewed 2 or 3 years before that, and we were talking about baseball. You wrote, if you remember, you wrote a story for the New York Times about the Cubs.
I did. I wrote, I did the op-ed page for the New York Times on the Cubs' very first night game.
Yeah, and I remembered reading that and talking to you about it. But the cool thing was, one of the first plays I ever saw was you and Glenn Ross with Peter Falk.
Oh, wow, right. Yes, I was.
I'm a huge Peter Falk fan. But I saw that play, and I just said, wow, that looks like fun. And I haven't been a professional actor for a long time, and I've done a lot of plays around here. But that play really, even as a young kid, I was in my early 20s, and I saw you in that play, and I've gone out. One of my favorite movies is Things Change.
Oh, with Don Ameche. Oh,
yeah.
I love doing it.
Yeah, just a great movie. And, of course, House of Games. And now you're on Criminal Minds. And, you've had a great career. And I'm just tickled that you took some time out from your busy day to give me a call and give me some tips, because at least I know I'm on the right track for Marvin.
Oh, you are. Just go out, have a good time, and just know that you're a winner. You know what I mean?
Right.
In one respect, you're a winner. I mean, it's you have to look at it that way. You have to be positive. You have to be strong. And that's what's great about the play, I think. I mean, it's like all the characters, you know, they're very well-defined individuals, and you just happen to represent, everybody who's not a Cub fan, you know. So,
well, I'll tell you, if my director gives me any other direction, I'm going to say, hey, I talked to the guy who wrote the play.
You know what?
The Cubs might be playing the Dodgers in the playoffs, so that Chicago connection, you might have some fun out there in the playoffs.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it. I certainly hope so. Yeah, we're gearing up for that, and we're just hoping for the best. And like I said, my take on it has also been this. When people ask me, what's my ultimate dream? My ultimate dream is that the Cubs win the World Series, and then we actually can safely abolish baseball and embrace soccer like the rest of the world, and then the rest of it'll ensure world peace, because then the whole rest of the world will say, look, they've given up their national pastime in order to embrace the beautiful game which the rest of us play on this planet, and there's no reason to continue playing baseball anymore. The Cubs have won
right.
the world.
But first, the Cubs have to win for that to happen.
But first, they have to win, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for taking time. Joe Mantegna, one of Chicago's very own, you make us so proud for the great career that you've carved out, and you'll be doing another season of Criminal Minds. It's been a very great show. My wife loves that show. We watch it every week.
Thank you very much. It's always great to talk to the hometown.
Okay, well, I'm a Paisan, so thank you so much for giving me a call.
My pleasure. You take care.
All right, take care, Joe. Very cool. Joe Mantegna from L.A. calling in to give me some tips on my upcoming Bleacher Bums appearance. We'll be back right after this. All right. Let me hear ya. A one. A two. A three. Don't win, it's a shame. One, two. At the old ball game. Hey! Oh, boy. Welcome back to whatever this is tonight. I'm Elton Jim Toronto, filling in for Justin Kaufman. We'll be here till 11 o'clock or so. And sometimes, you know, the fates just work in great ways. And so, you know, I had a feeling, I had a hope, I had a fingers crossed. My friend George Bliss said, you know, I might be able to get Joe Montana to call into your show tonight. Because I said, you know, I'm going to be talking about this Bleacher Bum show that I'm in. And he said, well, maybe I can do that. We'll see. So he sent him an email, and he said, well, I'll try. But I figured, okay, you know, he's being nice. And sure enough, not only does he call, but he calls in right before the segment that I'm going to have with Judy Grant, who is the director of the production I'm in of Bleacher Bums with the Westchester Civic Theater Group. Judy, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Jim. What a hard act to follow.
I was just going to say, so now you know, I just got some acting tips from the guy who wrote the play, Judy.
Yes, I heard.
So
you tell him you were going to diss the director.
Yes. So, I mean, I appreciate your point of view, but I'm going with Joe.
I understand. I do. I gotta agree with you. Listen, I apologize. My throat is a little hoarse. I was at that 13-inning game last night.
Did you stay all 13 innings?
Well, I'd like to say yes, but we left in 12.
Oh, you left in 12?
Well, I know.
Yeah, well, who knows? It could have went on till, I mean, it could have went on till 17 innings. Who knows, right?
Exactly.
Well, I should say that, like I said, Judy Grant is directing a production of the Bleacher Bums, which will be opening on September 17th at the theater at St. Joe's High School in Westchester, which is on 22nd Street. And you are the are you just a director? Or are you the founder of the theater group?
I am one of the original members of the group. The group's been around about 5 years. We took this little group from St. Joe's, who had no theater department, and we said, well, gosh, nice theater, we'll use it. And since we started doing plays there, their theater department is built up, and a lot of the St. Joe's alumni have pitched in and donated sound equipment and refurbished the theater. And so we've got the theater departments going again as well. So that it's great to have arts in the school.
Yeah, no kidding. Especially that's always the first thing that's cut. So whenever anybody can do something, especially on a private level, and especially with St. Joe's being a private school, certainly their funds are limited. So it's great that people are getting involved, and it's great that that you started that. I should say that that this play is being directed by Judy Grant, and she's no poser.
I am a pub fan from the day one.
Yes. In fact, not only at the original auditions was Judy wearing a Cub t-shirt, but at every rehearsal, she wears some kind of Cub paraphernalia. And I also did notice, if you don't mind me mentioning this, but you even have a Cubs emblem tattoo on the back of your neck.
Right on my neck. Right on my neck. To the day I die.
Yes. So, so you're certainly, so this has to be a fun play for you to be directing, being such a Cub fan. Like you said, you were just there last night.
Yeah, this is something that I have actually been trying to get them to do for a while. And this is actually my directorial debut, but I am so lucky. I am working with just a magnificent cast. Everybody is so wonderful. Everybody's putting their heart and soul into it. Jim, you are fabulous. You are one of my prize students. we have a lot of people. Everybody's putting their heart into it, which is just, it's wonderful.
Well, I was happy to see that, because I've always enjoyed this play. I remember being a little kid on Channel 11 in the 80s, I think they showed it again, but in the 70s, Channel 11 taped the production of Bleacher Bums and put it on Channel 11. I remember watching it then because I was a big Cub fan and enjoying it. And I've always looked around when I look at auditions around the city for productions of Bleacher Bums, and a lot of times they're kind of far away, or you know, so yeah. But this one was close to where I live, and I just got done doing a play, and I said, well, let me just see if I can be a part of this, and I was very happy to be cast, and I'm having a ball playing this character, and it's going to be really fun to see the show continue in rehearsals now to progress, yeah, and to get ready for an audience in only about, what, 2 or 3 weeks?
It is in about 2 or 3 weeks, so I'm getting a little nervous. I think everybody's stepping up to the plate. I think that's great. Everybody's got their head in the game. See all my baseball little...
Yeah, I'm hearing all your puns there, Judy, believe me.
My little things going. Yeah, no, it's going to be a great show. I mean, again, we have, not only do we have 9 wonderful actors in the show, but we have the 10th actor, a.k.a. our set, which is Wrigley Field. Makes you feel very at home. It's very, we're ready.
What's cool about the play itself, as Joe Mantegna was explaining, I don't know if you got a chance to hear the interview with him.
Yeah.
The thing about the play is, as I now am immersed in it, not just having seen it, but now reading it and studying it and performing it, is that, you know, and this isn't a knock at all. It's really not overly, I mean, it's I guess it's a comedy, but there's really not a lot of per se funny lines. Where the real fun and drama and poignancy and excitement of the play comes because of the environment, like you're saying, with the set of being Wrigley Field, yeah, and the fact that every character in the play is really a character unto themselves. And so it is the characters themselves and the way they interact that makes the play fun and exciting. It's really not, you know, a laugh riot in terms of like really funny lines like a Woody Allen play. There is a few, right, good lines here, right, and there, but it's really the camaraderie and the way that the fans are reacting, and they're such diehard Cub fans, and they're living and dying on every pitch and living and dying on every game, and it is the way that they interact, and it's the way that the, yeah, play, you know, recreates that kind of excitement at a Cub game, especially in the bleachers with these diehard fans where, like I said, every pitch is monumental. They are paying attention. They are groaning and cheering, and that's what makes the play.
They're keeping score, and they got their heads in the game. There are, you know, people there. They're just kind of this ragtag group of friends, you know, that what they have in common is their love for Cubs baseball. And that is something that so many people, you know, win, lose, or draw, Cub fans, you can't get it out of their blood. And I love that. I have, you know, people don't understand, people who are not Cubs fans don't understand what it's like to root for a team that stunk for so many years. But still, you still love them, and every day you still hope, this could be the one that turns it around.
Well, it's ironic that that we're doing the play this season because, like I said, you know, the Cubs right now have the best, record in baseball, yeah, and there's no doubt they're going to be in the playoffs, and there really is, yeah, high expectations for them not to just get to the World Series but actually win it. But the fact of the matter is that when this play was written in 1977 by Joe Mantegna, yeah, and the other people at the Organic Theater, the Cubs were not a very good team. And that's what also brings charm to the play. And even though that we're doing an updated version from 1998, the Cubs obviously didn't win the World Series that year either. But the fact is that, you know, there was a sense that, you know, it's interesting now that the Cubs are so good because, you know, people may, I don't think they're going to forget, but, you know, there was a time where, you know, the Cubs were just the lovable losers. And
yeah,
I think a lot of Cub fans like yourself, I would assume, a lot of Cub fans are still having problems getting to realize that this is a really good team. They're waiting for something bad to happen, and I don't think it's going to. This is a good team, and they need to embrace that.
But you can't, like, I refuse to say the WS words, you know, that because I don't want to jinx it, you know? I don't want to, and which is why we decided to produce this show in September. We were, you know, we could have booked it in October when it was a little bit cooler and a little closer to the end, but I am not going to be the one responsible for I am not going to have that on my conscience.
So it's not, it won't be really up to Chris Bryant or John Lester or any other of the Cubs. It's basically going to be, if you did a play, that's why they would have lost.
It's all on me.
Yeah,
I
see.
The pressure is amazing.
Well, that's
amazing.
Well, that's the way a true Cub fan thinks, that they somehow have power over that.
Wear your rally hats and your lucky socks and your good shirt, and, you know, you bring it, you know?
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. As a Cub fan, even last year, it was a real fun summer. We have had a real fun summer being Cub fans this year, which doesn't happen very often. Last year, it was a real fun summer. You know, you are waiting for the other shoe to drop as a Cub fan, hoping that it won't, but you just...
Well, all I have to say is a couple of weeks ago, the Cubs were playing the... Milwaukee Brewers, who are one of the worst teams in baseball this year.
Yeah.
And they were up by two or three runs in the ninth inning. And, you know, the Cubs were pitching, and it was at Wrigley. And, you know, in the grand scheme of things, they were playing the Milwaukee Brewers. It was just a game in August. And it didn't really mean much if they won or lost, but they were still winning the game. But there was two or three men on, and Milwaukee sort of had a rally in the top of the ninth, and they showed pictures of the fans, and you would have thought that it was 2003, in the bottom of the ninth. I mean, it was like, this is Milwaukee, and it's July. This game doesn't mean anything. And yet they were hanging, like, on every pitch, and I was like, these Cub fans need to just to ease up and realize this is a good team. And they are not gonna, and they're not gonna crumble.
They're not gonna crumble. And you know what's different about this team? You know, it's been a long time since Cub fans have been able to be interested and still hopeful past the All-Star break. He's Joe Mantegna, absolutely right, and it's in the script. You know, nobody loses money after Batman right.
after 4th of July. Yeah.
After the 4th of July.
Well,
and it's true. But, you know, this team, the team that we've got now, they never say die. It doesn't matter how bad they were yesterday. They were down. They came back. Then in the top of the 12th, you know, Pirates got a run, but that didn't stop them. They still pulled it out.
Well, and that's the spirit, of the play, the Bleacher Bums, that is going to be being put on by the Westchester Civic Theater Group, and it's going to be at
yes.
St. Joe's High School, which is on 22nd Street in yes. in Westchester. So, what are the dates? What are the dates? And what's the? How do we get tickets?
Okay, so it's Saturday and Sunday, September 17th and 18th. We have a 7:30 show on Saturday and a matinee 2:00 on Sunday. And then the following weekend, 23, 24, 25th, Friday the 24th, or 3rd and Saturday the 24th are 7:30s. And then the final show is Sunday, September 25th at 2 p.m. So to get tickets, you could call 708-928-5010 or visit WestchesterPlays.com, and it's really worth it. Well, you get to see Jim Toronto for having a day.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time. I'm having a fun time being in this play because I am a Cub fan too, and so I'm looking forward to finally getting it on its feet in a couple weeks. Thanks to Judy Grant for joining us here, and I'll see you tomorrow at rehearsal.
Thanks, Jim. Go Cubs, go!
There you go. Judy Grant from the Westchester Theater Group, director of the play Bleacher Bums, which I'll be appearing in September. She gave you the information there on tickets. So if you want to come out and see a fun play, why don't you do it? Hold on now. We'll be back right after this. Yeah, you could tell Elif picked this one. What's this one, Elif?
This is Panic Station by Muse.
Awesome.
Who also wrote Take Me Out to the Ball Game.
What?
No. I was alluding to our earlier conversation.
Yeah. All right, I can dig this. I can dig that.
It's more fun with the lyrics.
Are there any lyrics, or are they ever coming?
Yeah, but this is the instrumental.
Oh, I see. Okay. Because in the business, it's called a bump. And the bump is the music that provides, as we say in the business, a bed for the announcer to talk over, like I am right now. And that announcer tonight is Elton Jim Toronto here at WGN, filling in for Justin Kaufman, and we'll be on till 11 o'clock. Elif, I'm going to say your name Elif now 17,000 times since I know how to pronounce it correctly. Do we know if Patty is on after us today?
Yes.
So Patty Vasquez will be on her usual time at 11 o'clock. Talking before about food earlier in the show, we were talking about how the Kentucky Fried Chicken 11 Herbs and Spices, the secret recipe, was unveiled. No, it's chicken. It's not veal. Exposed, shall we say, by some reporters at the Chicago Tribune. We don't know if it's officially, but they did taste it. They did cook it according to this recipe that they found, and it tasted as if it was pretty, pretty, pretty close. And we're hoping to talk to somebody from the Taste of Polonia Festival, which is happening on September 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 5th this week, and then over the Labor Day weekend. And it's a huge, huge festival out on the northwest side there, near Milwaukee and Lawrence at the Copernicus Center, which used to be the old Gateway Theater for you folks that have lived in Chicago for many years. The good old Gateway Theater became the Copernicus Center. If you remember when Pope John Paul came to Chicago in 1979, I believe he either visited the Copernicus Center or certainly drove past it, because that's kind of my neighborhood where I grew up. And I remember a friend of mine, Matt, and his family, they went, and as the Pope drove past from the airport, they saw the Pope and they waved at the Pope. I remember my friend Matt was just ecstatic. I saw the Pope. And he is still Pope John Paul II, who now is a saint, is still a huge, huge figure in Polish history. In fact, over the weekend, there was an interesting show about the Polish immigrant on Channel 11. And then after it, there was a story about Pope John Paul II and how he played such an instrumental role in eliminating communism. And he really was a political figure as much as he was a religious figure. And I'm bringing up this some of this Polish talk not only because of the Taste of Polonia, but the fact is that even though I have, as I mentioned before, my surname is Italian, Turano, T-U-R-A-N-O. And yes, I am related to the Toronto Baking Company, but I'm not involved in it. My side of the family was not involved in it. That's cousins, but it's still very cool to drive down the street and see those trucks go by with my name on them.
I didn't know that, and I'm a huge fan of Toronto bread.
You're a big fan of the bread?
Yes.
She likes Radiohead and Toronto Bakery bread?
Yes.
What is your favorite type of bread?
It's the white oval-shaped one.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they have done an amazing. Is born and raised here in Chicago. They are based in Berwyn on Roosevelt Road, and
yes.
You see those trucks everywhere. It has been really a great American success story, because I believe the founder, the way I've always been explained to me is, I believe the founder, Mariano, and my grandfather, who I never knew, he died before I was born, on the Toronto side, I believe they were cousins. So, you know, I'm related. You know, my dad knew them more, obviously, and then, you know, as cousins. But by the time it came to me being born, we weren't all that close. And so it was, you know, kind of, you know, three or four, once removed kind of thing. But we certainly keep in touch with them, and you know, we see them at weddings and events like that. And but they have really done an incredible job, and they do have some great bread. In fact, my favorite Toronto bread, Elif, E-L-I-F, the producer today, she was talking about her favorite Toronto bread. My favorite bread is actually made, the Toronto favorite bread is made specifically for Mr. Submarine. I'm not giving any free plugs here. I'm just telling you. I never knew this. I went to Mr. Submarine. There's several around the Chicago area. And I just remember having a sub from there and going, wow, this is really good bread. Because really the key to a good sub sandwich is the bread. I mean, the cold cuts, obviously. But a really good sub sandwich also has to have a really good bread to go with it. And I really like the bread. And then later on, I found out that Toronto supplies them the bread. And I actually saw Ron Toronto, who runs the bakery now, at an event one time. And I said, you know, I can't find the bread that you make, that I get at Mr. Submarine in the stores, because I want to make my own sub sandwich at home. And he said, we make that specifically for Mr. Submarine.
Wow, what an honor.
Yeah, so that's not just any bread. And like I said, I'm not giving any free plugs here, but if you ever go to Mr. Submarine, you taste that sub. That is really, really good bread. And everything they have, it's all in the stores. I remember as a young kid, there were several smaller Toronto bakeries, and then the brothers involved all consolidated. And I remember that, you know, every so often you'd see some Toronto bread in a Jewel or a Dominick's. And then suddenly as the years go by, you saw more and more and more. And now they've become just a huge, huge, you know, bakery supplying bread all around the country, if not all around the world. So kudos to them. But what I wanted to get to was not a little history on Toronto Bakery. But more is that my other side, my mom's side, I'm all Polish. And I've always had more of a connection to my Italian side, my mom's side. I didn't really see much of her family. And my name is Toronto, and I look more Italian than Polish. So I've always been identified more with my Italian background. But my mom was so proud of her Polish heritage. She was born here, but her parents were born in Poland. And she spoke fluent Polish, and she was involved in, like, I'm not exaggerating, about 15 different Polish community clubs, women's clubs, civic clubs, all around the city. She was, leadership in many of them. In fact, just before she passed away 10 years ago, she was given a life membership of the Polish Museum of America, and I still have the medallion that they put around her neck. And so I'm certainly, you know, trying to embrace both sides of my ethnicity. And in fact, she will have passed away 10 years this year in September, day before her birthday, actually. And so to give her a little tribute, we're going to take a trip to Poland in a couple of months. And I, before she passed away, I clipped a few locks of her hair. And so I've saved those locks of her hair. And so I'm going to take them with me to Poland. And I'm going to bury them in Poland soil, because I think that she would really appreciate to have a piece of herself in the country that she really loved so much and was so proud of. So anyway, hopefully we'll talk to somebody from Taste of Polonia. If not, I'll give you some of the information anyway, because it really is a great festival. My mom used to volunteer at that Taste of Polonia every year, every day. She was there 12 hours a day. She was really a tireless volunteer. And anyway, so it's a great event, and we'll give you some information on that. We will take a quick break and be right back after this. No switching. Oh, Ellen.
Do you like this
one? Oh, now you're talking. Peter Gabriel climbing up on Salisbury Hill. Now you're talking. Enough with your muse and your garbage. Uh-huh. Now you're playing some music. Wah, 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 wah. Climbing up on Salisbury Hill, I could see the city lights. Great song. And that actually, if you don't know, Salisbury Hill is Peter Gabriel's take on his breakup with Genesis. That's what that song is about. You could pack your things, I've come to take you home, leaving the band. Elif looks at me like I'm crazy.
No, I don't know a lot about him, but I saw him actually when he was with Sting.
You saw that show?
Yes, yes.
Oh, I wanted to see that so much. How was that?
It was so good. Because
they played together as well as apart, right?
Yeah, they did both. I went with my mom. It was her Mother's Day gift.
Wow, nice gift. Nice daughter.
Well, I split it with my family, of course.
But still, nice.
But it was a really, really, really good show. And it was about 2.5, 3 hours as well.
I've seen the I had something on that date, and I couldn't go, but I'm a huge, huge Peter Gabriel fan. I've seen him several times in concert, and just love his music, and he's such a great artist. And I do like Sting. I mean, there's some things about Sting I don't like, and some I do. But those two together had to have been just every song had to be great.
It was so cool.
And there are probably some really good musicians, too.
Oh, yeah. They had some really good music. They had some great instrumentalists and really amazing vocalists.
Yeah.
What's that song, Don't Give Up?
Oh, yeah.
Don't Give
Up. That was from the So album. He did that initially with Kate Bush.
Yes.
Don't give up.
But I think, and my mom agrees, that the girl who... who sang that part
was better than Kate
Bush.
Was
so much better.
Really?
Yeah, we had chills. We both had
that's
chills.
A great set. The So album is the one that Peter Gabriel really had a hit with that really made him a major star. He had always been popular as the lead singer of Genesis in the late 60s and early 70s, and then he left. As a solo artist, he was fairly, you know, he had a nice career. He certainly had more of a cult following. He had a couple of hits. He had Shock the Monkey and Games Without Frontiers, but then when he put out the So album, I believe it was 85, that had Sledgehammer and Big Time, and he became a huge MTV because he had some amazing and very creative videos to go with those songs. And so, especially Sledgehammer, was kind of a stop motion thing, like those Christmas specials like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and stuff. And along that, I mean, Sledgehammer is just a great pop dance song, and it was just perfect for the 80s. And it really elevated him to a whole other, you know, level where people then looked at him as a, you know, as a superstar. And I've seen him in concert. He's so good. He's really a true artist. I mean, he's not just a vocalist or, you know, because I'm sure the lighting had to have been very cool too, right?
It was. I remember they had a really cool backdrop of backdrop lighting.
Yeah, he's very dramatic and he's got that kind of a raspy voice. It's not the greatest voice, but it's very expressive, and he's just great. I love Peter Gabriel. So there, wow. I mean, you pulled one out of your hat there.
Well, we connected on that one.
Yes, definitely. I mean, Muse, I'll give you, but wow, you hit the mark right in the sweet spot. Wow, Peter Gabriel and Salisbury Hill, which is one of my favorite songs of his. So I'm going to say your name correctly the rest of the show just for that.
Excellent.
Right, Elif?
Okay, Elvis.
There you go. Jim Toronto here at WGN Radio, and we're filling in for Justin Kaufman tonight. Thankfully, we do have our person from Taste of Polonia, but we're going to wait till after the news so we can have a nice little chat and give you a little a highlight as to what's going on over there. It's on Milwaukee and Lawrence, which is the heart of the Polish neighborhoods here in Chicago. So if we can, we'll talk a little bit about what's going on at Taste of Polonia. Hey, ho, hey, ho! It's the Jim Toronto Polka Hour. Those are the polkas of Myron Florin. And you may know Myron Florin if you ever listened to the great Lawrence Welk show. There is Myron on the accordion, and isn't he wonderful? The scary part is there are some Saturday nights when I'm not doing anything, and on one of the PBS stations in the Chicago area, not Channel 11, but that Lakeshore one, they have the best of the Lawrence Welk show, and I hate to admit it, but I watch it. There's some really good songs. And I love Lawrence because, you know, there's the little champagne bubbles. It's such bad TV. It's fantastic. And there's the audience is dancing, and there's Lawrence with the multicolored suits, and oh, and Myron, who I'm playing here, was his key accordion player, Myron Florian. Anyway, you'd say, well, why is Jim Toronto, like obvious Italian name, talking about Polish music and Polish things? Well, the fact of the matter is one half of me is Italian and the other half is pure Polish. In fact, so Polish that my mom's maiden name is Kielbasa. And if anybody knows anything about Polish, Kielbasa means sausage. And so my dad's nickname for her was Laurie Sausage. And then you wonder where my skewed sense of humor came from. So I'm very excited today to talk to Greg Kobolinski, who is the managing director of the Copernicus Center, to talk about Taste of Polonia. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Thank you. Good evening.
You know, I don't know, how long have you worked there at the Copernicus Center?
Well, I've been involved there almost from its inception as a small child. My father was one of the founders.
Oh, really?
Lately, I've come to manage the center, and I'm proud to say that we're going to host the 36th annual Taste of Polonia this year, which predates the Taste of Chicago by 1 year. So I think we should have trademarked that taste name.
Yeah, no kidding. You guys are the ones that gave them the idea.
Well, I don't know. I don't want to take credit for it, but we certainly outdo them in Polish food, I'll tell you that.
Now, just by any chance, did you ever know my mom, Lorraine Toronto?
I may have.
Yeah, that name doesn't sound familiar, though.
You know what? If she introduced herself as Kielbasa, I certainly would have known her.
Well, I know she was on the Copernicus Foundation. She was a member of that.
That's right.
So
right, and the foundation still owns the center, and the foundation still organizes the festival. It's the main fundraising event of the foundation.
Yeah, I mean, she was at that Copernicus Center so much, and she always volunteered for. Probably every one of the Taste of Polonia. She had those costumes, and
oh, yeah.
She used to be in all right. the Polish Independence Day parades here in Chicago, and so she was a very very enthusiastic and very proud of her Polish heritage, and so I'm actually excited because I'm going to be going to Poland in a couple of months.
Well, that's fantastic, and that's why we encourage the public to come out and visit the taste. It showcases not only the great food, but many of the great folklore and arts of the Polish community, and we certainly have a lot of things that people can see there that would help them plan a trip to Poland.
Yeah, that's why I want to go there.
I
definitely want to go there and soak up some of the atmosphere and see what some of the foods. I mean, I certainly know some of the... You know, the standbys, your pierogi. Isn't that how you say it? Pierogi?
Pierogi, right.
Pierogi.
Right. Right.
And
right.
And other types of things, but also just some other aspects of it. We're going to go to Krakow. See, I said Krakow.
Okay.
Not Krakow. I said Krakow.
Well, that's okay. Either way, it's a beautiful city.
Yeah, it's supposed to be. And now there, and I guess there's a town that my grandfather was from called Tarnow. Tarnow? Something like that.
Tarnów, right.
Yes, that's where he's from.
Yes.
So hopefully that's
Absolutely.
About 30 minutes out from Krakow, so I'm going to go there too. And as I said before, she was so proud of her Polish heritage that I before she passed away about 10 years ago, actually it'll be 10 years ago this year, that's why we're going, I'm going to take a few locks of her hair and bury them in Poland.
Well, that's very nice. That's a nice gesture.
Yeah, so a piece
that's
of her
a great gesture.
But let's talk about the Polish thing going on here at the Copernicus Center, which is right near the corner of Milwaukee and Lawrence. Used to be the good old Gateway Theater.
It used to be the Gateway Theater. Now, that theater was built in 1930 as the first theater built in Chicago for the talking movies, and they weren't sure if those would really take off. So when people come to the festival, they're going to have an opportunity to walk inside that theater and see a real Chicago monument.
Wow. In fact, I was very impressed. Recently at the Copernicus Center, you had Elvis Costello.
Well, we had Elvis Costello. I think after him, we had Sophia Loren. And last year, we were proud to welcome the President of the United States. So
I mean, that's
had a few dignitaries.
Yeah, no kidding. That's amazing. But so give me a quick rundown about Taste of Polonia. If I've never been before, it's on September 2nd through the 5th. But when I'm going to be there, what are some of the things that I should be looking to enjoy there?
Well, there, you know, a lot of people come there for the food. We have a lot of food vendors serving different varieties of Polish food. And
What are some of the foods that I should be looking for at some of the different stands there?
You know, it varies. You have the standards of the gołąbki and the pierogi and the kielbasa. We have some vendors last year. They invented the bionic gołąbki, and they put they put jardiniere in a gołąbki, and it sold out.
And what's a gołąbki? I remember my mom talking about gołąbki. What's a gołąbki?
It's a cabbage roll.
Right. Okay.
You find that in so many different ethnic cultures, and it's just the Polish version of it. So
yeah.
There are people putting different slants on a lot of the different Polish food. We actually have Polish cooking classes. So if you really want to even see how to make this stuff, you can sign up or, you know, just walk in and find out how the food is made. And so there's a lot of different activities going on there. Art shows, concerts. On Saturday, we have the Lincolnwood Chamber Orchestra playing in the theater. So we run the gamut from rock music to polkas to Polish music to theater and children's events.
What are the hours?
The hours, we start on Friday at 5. All the other days we start at noon and go to 10. And we encourage everybody to come out. We know we're a block away from the Jefferson Park Station where, you know, the Metro train stops and the Blue Line stops. And we encourage everybody to please take public transportation. Jefferson Park's a wonderful place, but we get 25 to 30,000 people out there every year.
Wow, you get that many people.
Yes, and public transportation is the way to go. You get off the train, you walk a block, and you're right there.
But there is some a free shuttle service, too, isn't there, for parking?
Right. You know, we are a multicultural facility, and we cooperate with the Irish American Center just 3 or 4 blocks down the road, and they have generously donated their parking lot to us. And so there you can park there, and there's a shuttle bus that runs nonstop direct to the festival.
Nice.
And we encourage everyone to take public transportation. If you can't, go park at our friends at the Irish American Center and take the shuttle bus.
So have you seen the popularity of this fest continue to grow year after year?
You know, it does. Originally, there were just a lot of Polish people, and now the mix has really gone 50-50. We have about half the people come there are born in Poland. The other half are Polish Americans, such as yourself and myself. We have entertainment. It's not only polkas. There is a polka stage for the for the polka enthusiasts, but there are 4 stages there. And in addition to the polka stage, there's a what we call the tribute stage. And for all of us that were born a little earlier than the millennium generation, we have the classic rock bands performing all day long, every day for 4 days. So you can eat that Polish food and listen to some great classic rock music, and then wander over to the Polish stage and listen to some Polish music, go to the kids stage or go to the polka stage.
So
I think we have something for everyone.
So what is, once again, I want, because like I said, I'm interested also to open it up, as you said, to people that maybe are not Polish. Doesn't mean you just to go to taste the polony, you don't have to be Polish. There's going to be different types of food. So, you know, pierogies are kind of a dumpling that have different, you know, fillings in them.
Right.
And then
right.
You said the gołąbki is kind of a cabbage roll with like rice in it, or like what's that?
It's meat and rice that with a tomato sauce and wrapped in a cabbage roll. We have different types of kielbasas. There are a lot of homemade pierogies, so you can go the gamut from a pierogi with cheese in it or meat in it or potatoes or fruits. Because from southern Poland, from Tarnów, where your family is from, they're famous for making pierogies with fruit in them.
And oh, really?
My grandfather in northern Poland would never touch a pierogi.
Oh, how funny. Oh, really?
you could eat them all, and nobody's going to turn an eye and say, hey, you shouldn't be eating that, because we've got the whole gamut.
And so how does it work, too? Is there an admission price, and then I just pay for what I do at each stand, or are there tickets, or how does that work?
There's an admission. It's $5 before 5 and $10 after 5. And we sell food tickets, and those coupons will get you, just like Taste of Chicago, will get you a huge plate of food. And we have a lot of cold Polish beer on hand So you get to taste a variety of different Polish beer products and enjoy yourself in a wonderful community, because, you know, we're so proud to be part of that Jefferson Park community on the northwest side there, and we invite everyone from Chicago to come visit us.
Well, that is my old stomping grounds. I was born near Six Corners, born and raised near like Cicero and Roscoe. So that is right. I went to St. Pat's on Belmont, and I played baseball at Portage Park and Kilbourne Park, and I went to Butler Bowl, which is right not far from you on Milwaukee and Foster over there, and
absolutely,
yeah. So I know the area very well, and I'm actually it's nice to see that whole Six Corners area, and obviously Jefferson Park now is becoming the cool hipster trendy area.
You know, we're trying. We're the big cultural anchor of that community. And, the Copernicus Center is sponsored by the Polish community, but we're really a multi-ethnic center, and we feel that it's our duty to serve that Northwest community and bring people into Jefferson Park. It's just a wonderful community and showcase what we have. And part of that, we've got a huge art exhibit that the Jefferson Park Historical Society is going to be putting up in our annex, where you can go back in time and see what the community looked like when the theater was built. So there are a lot of very interesting things that you could wander around and do. I don't think you could do it in one day. I really think it takes a couple of days to see the whole fest.
Well, I'm definitely, as I said, I've gone there in the past because my mom used to volunteer there every year and every day and almost
right.
from beginning to end. And so I certainly had gone there many times, but I'm certainly very inspired and excited to go there this year, because I said I'll be going to Poland. And so I definitely want to get a nice, precursor and get into the culture a little before I get there. And so I'm looking forward to that. And so thank you very much, Greg Kobolinski, for giving us a little rundown. Is there anywhere that anyone can go to get more information about the fest?
Yeah, we have a special website, TOP, for Taste of Polonia, topchicago.org. And you can get the whole schedule of all the bands on the four stages, and you could see all the activities inside, the hours of the casino, the hours of all the food classes. You get everything on that website and how to get there, and how to have a good time.
Okay, great. Greg Kobolinski, the managing director of the Copernicus Center, which is putting on for what year now? 30 what?
36.
36th year for the Taste of Polonia near Milwaukee, near Lawrence. And you could see the steeple of the Copernicus Center off the Kennedy. So it's easy to get to. You just get off the Lawrence exit there, and you're right there. Thanks a lot, Greg. I appreciate it. And save a pierogi for me.
I'm going to save a cold Okocim Polish beer for you.
Oh, what's the name of that? I got to write that one down. What's it called?
Okocim.
Okay, you got to spell that, because as we know, Polish has very few consonants or vowels.
You know what? You just tell me you want a Polish beer and you'll be all right.
Okay, we're great. All right, well, thanks a lot for calling in, and hope it's a very successful taste this year.
Thank you very much. Have a good night.
All right. Yeah, Taste of Polonia. Check it out. It sounds like it's going to be a good time. And there's some great, great Polish comfort food if you want to. And I'm sure there's some great Polish beers, too. So that's Taste of Polonia starting on Friday and going through the Labor Day weekend on Milwaukee and Lawrence. It's about 10:52. This is Jim Toronto filling in for Justin Kaufman. We'll be setting up the table here for Patty Vasquez right after around 11, so keep it tuned. We'll be back after this. Jim Toronto here at WGN, 720 AM. I've been filling in for Justin Kaufman, and man, did those 4 hours fly by. I had a great time today, and Rob, it was somewhat nice to see you and talk to you again.
Oh, stop. I love when you're in. I love seeing you.
No, I love talking to you. It's great. It's great to see you again. You used to fill in quite a bit when we used to be doing the afternoon show, and so it's great to spend a lot of time with you and actually have conversations with you, as opposed to just doing your little news things here and there. So we always have my
little dog and pony.
That little
show
news
up here.
Stuff that you know. I look at your news like the TV executives look at television programming. It's the stuff between the commercials.
Yeah,
it's the stuff between me. Okay, yes, I'm a narcissist. You have to be.
You know what? I try to bring a little substance
to
the thing. You know, I try.
Hey, I don't even know what you talk about, but your voice makes it sound very important.
Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah, the nice dulcet tones of a Rob Martyr.
You got to deliver with authority.
No, we had some fun today. I mean, my gosh, talk about a wide-ranging show. We started out talking about the 11 herbs and spices secret recipe of Kentucky Fried Chicken revealed. We had Joe Montana make a phone call to talk about bleacher bums, and we ended up talking about pierogi. Where else are you going to find that, Rob?
I gained 5 pounds just listening. Seriously.
Where are you going to find that?
You know, I'm so interested in the Kentucky Fried Chicken story just because I got a hold of the Mrs. Fields cookie recipe.
Oh, did you ever make them?
Tried it at home. Nowhere near what you get at the mall.
Yeah,
Nowhere near.
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, but and even if this Kentucky Fried Chicken turns out to be the official one, even though the company is denying it, at the end of the day, I think it's a win-win for everybody. So
now, if I could distill Maker's Mark bourbon the way they actually do it in the bottles you get at Benny's, then I'd be ahead of the game.
I didn't know you were such an alcoholic. Wow.
No. I'm on the road to recovery.
Very good. Well, that's good. Hey, Rob, can I just say one thing?
Yes.
One day at a time.
Thank you.